20 minutes or so early. Apologize for the delay. Please abandon your seat with your seatbelts fastened until we turn off the sign. Thanks.
Hey, welcome to Kelly Corrigan Wonders as we touch down in Boston, Massachusetts. I'm traveling with my producer, Tammy Stedman. We are two middle-aged women who graduated from college a long time ago, and most of our experience these days is in writing tuition checks. And we got to wondering, what is the point of a liberal arts education in 2022?
It's from the Iliad, ever to excel. What does that mean?
What does that mean? Join us as we figure it out with Biz Brocker at Boston College. We'll be right back with Kelly Corrigan Wonders. I wonder if all the kids are going to look at us. Do you think they're going to look at us and be like, what's with the old ladies?
They're going to be like, are these the new TAs?
Old ladies.
Hi, we're old ladies with suitcases on campus. Didn't really think that through.
I feel like we're fitting right in already.
Yeah.
Hey, this is Kelly Corrigan. Welcome back to Kelly Corrigan Wonders. I'm on the campus of Boston College, starting a new series called Live from College with my trusty producer, Tammy Stedman. And our animating question is, what really is the point of a liberal arts education circa 2022? And the way we're going to get to the bottom of it is we're going to bounce around a bunch of different campuses around the country until we form some sort of cogent answer to that basic question. Today, we're on our way to class with a professor named Biz Brocker. I had a kid named Annie O'Neill, who I coached in lacrosse, who told me this was her all-time favorite college class. So I listened, and we found our way to her classroom.
What does ever to excel mean? Does it mean pursuing perfection? It could sound like it.
Dr. Biz Brocker does not like perfection. She doesn't believe it's a worthy goal. And this is one of the many things I learned when I sat down with her after class for this conversation. So, Biz, this is your first podcast ever. Is that what I'm understanding?
Yes.
Hey, welcome to the world. Welcome to the 21st century.
Thank you. I listen a lot, but I've never been on one.
That's crazy. You should probably have your own podcast.
Oh, you're sweet. Thank you.
All right. So, for starters, I just want to understand what your original ideas about college were. So did your parents go to college?
They did go to college. My dad started at a small liberal arts college, but then his mother got sick. And so he moved closer to home to a large state school.
And you're from Michigan?
I'm from Michigan.
And your parents are from Michigan?
Yeah. And then my mom lived at home while she went to college because back then girls didn't necessarily live in dormitories.
That's right. Bad things could happen in
right,
a dorm.
Exactly.
And they do. Mm-hmm. And so you grew up thinking, I am definitely going to college.
Yes. I was so ready to go to college. It was what I always wanted.
And when you thought about it, what were the parts that were sort of brightest in your mind?
I've always been a doer and a joiner and a leader. And so I saw it as opportunities. I went to a small private high school. I think our graduating class was 75 boys and girls. And so in that, there's limits, right? We certainly were a well-resourced high school, but I just saw so much opportunity and room to explore and be curious. And so that was very exciting to me. And then to go to college on the East Coast was kind of a dream. I knew people that had done this, and it sounded so interesting and exciting and exotic.
And sophisticated.
Sophisticated, yes.
And you were a big-time athlete in high school?
Yeah, I was a three-sport varsity letter winner. We had great athletics at my high school.
Were you a reader? Like, would you read books outside of class?
Yeah, I've always been a reader. My father is a voracious reader, was a voracious reader. And in fact, my dad read to me at night until I was 15 or 16 years old. He would read my history textbooks to me, and I'd say, Dad, it's time to stop this now. I'm too old for this. But
oh,
he always read to me at night. And my grandfather was a reader. My grandfather and my dad would exchange books all the time. And
yeah, so you witnessed it and you experienced it.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're snooping around the East Coast. Your coach is taking some girls campus by campus and you come to BC.
And it just felt right. And I've heard students say that time and time again. Parents will tell stories. One parent recently told me a story that they were up and down the East Coast looking at colleges, then went out to the Midwest, then even flew to the West Coast. And it was the last school that they were going to. They drove to BC and they drove in the parking garage, seven floors of concrete, and parked the car and stepped out of the car into the parking garage. And the boy said, "This is it." She said, "How about we walk? I heard it has a pretty campus. Let's walk around at least." He's like, "No, this feels right." And she said, "If he can feel that way about the parking garage, there's something committing."
Did you know that Boston College was liberal arts? And if you did you know what that meant?
Here's what I knew. I wouldn't have said that phrase necessarily. What I knew is that it had four undergraduate colleges. They had the College of Arts and Sciences, the School of Management, the School of Nursing, and the School of Education. And I came from a family of teachers. My mom, my sister, even my dad taught graduate level courses in accounting. And so education was big for us. I felt confident in wanting to be a teacher.
Oh, you did? Like, you came in on that path and you never veered?
Oh, I veered.
Oh.
I veered. I got into my second semester classes in education and said, "This is not for me. I do not want to be doing lesson plans and bulletin boards. It wasn't what I wanted." And I had a senior who was a freshman advisor back then. And I said, "I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm in the School of Education. I always wanted Boston College, but I don't want this degree." And she said, "You should come to class with me and go to my adolescent psych class, because you wouldn't have to necessarily change schools. And it's a human development path in the School of Education." And I went to that class and fell in love and never looked back.
Yeah. How long after college did you think, I want to be a college professor? Or were you in college when you thought, I want to stand in front of the room?
I never necessarily thought about being a college professor when I was an undergrad, because it seemed so far away. It was so shrouded in intense research and writing. And all I heard about was publish or perish. And I didn't want to be under the gun for publishing all the time, because I didn't know what I would publish. I didn't feel worthy of publishing anything. But at the time, after I graduated, and one piece that's changed is my mom, while my dad was a great reader, and the family would arguably say he's the academic of the family. In fact, my dad retired at 75 from a long life of consulting and accounting work, and went back to get his master's in history.
That's so cool.
So great. And what a great role model to be able to reinvent yourself. But my mother also reinvented herself from an art gym teacher in the elementary level to a small business owner. And so we owned a toy store in town, small town. And I always wanted to go into business with her. And so on my weekends and in my summers, I stayed in Boston and worked for FAO Schwartz Toy Stores, figuring I would learn the New York business, right? And then bring it back to the Midwest.
What was the name of the toy store?
The Village Toy Company. And so while I was working here in the city of Boston after graduation, I had been tapped on the shoulder by a faculty member somewhere in my sophomore year who said, "I do research in the summer. I have a grant, and I always take a couple undergrads and graduates on for the summer to work with me, and I'd love for you to work with me." And his name is John Dacey. I still work with him.
What was his research?
We started looking at high-risk behavior, and particularly in the Boston School District, what could we do to infuse in a curriculum that would allow children in the elementary and middle school years to say no to gangs. Mm. Not necessarily get out of gangs, but how do you get them to say no even before they are approached by gangs? How do you center someone's self-worth, self-confidence, and connection so that they say no to gangs?
Mm-hmm.
And so we were working on that research, and he was asking me these bigger questions that well before BC had a vocabulary around student formation. And he was asking me, "Do you like working in the toy stores? And what do you think you're giving back to the world? And where's the value? Where's your heart in this? And do you think you're good at it?" And why do you think it's a noble profession? And what do you want to do with that? And he suddenly helped me hear myself and my goals and the reasons behind what I was doing and what I was leaving on the table by not pursuing more of an education.
And so interesting to think about the value of those interactions with people who are caring adults that are not your parents.
Yes.
And the lever that that is. It's come up before on the pod where somebody will have had a really disadvantaged childhood in a number of ways, including parents who are neglectful or incapable of doing that hard work. And then someone fills in that space and all sorts of new avenues start appearing.
Absolutely. That's part of my vocational calling that I feel so committed to be able to be some student's sounding block. Mm-hmm. And also ask them the questions that sometimes we parents are too afraid to ask our own kids.
How many years were you out of college before you thought, I got to go back to school, I got to do this?
I was a year and a half out and I was working at FAO Schwartz and I wasn't feeling it anymore. I tell this story to my students. I just told it last week to my seniors. I was feeling the pressure. I was the assistant manager of an FAO Schwartz in a suburban mall, and the clientele was pretty demanding, and my buyers were in town. And in retail, buyers determine the bottom line. They determine what you have to sell and at what price point and how much you have to make. And so they were all there watching, and I was trying to manage them and the people in the store, and I went to help out at the cash wrap desk. And as I'm checking out, this woman said, oh my gosh, why don't you just smile? If you can't smile in a toy store, where can you smile? And my first reaction, which I didn't say out loud, but if you could read the bubble over my head, it said, what a bitch. Does she realize that my buyers are right behind me listening to this? And I went home and I told the story to my mom that night over the phone. And my mom said, maybe she's onto something. And I thought, are you kidding me? You're going to take her side?
Right.
And she said, if you're not happy, if strangers can tell, then maybe you should think about what you're doing.
Yeah.
And when I decided that I didn't want to go back to that job, I couldn't go back the next morning. Like that was,
yeah.
You can't go in and fake it.
No.
And so I called my parents again and said, what do I do? And so my mom and dad said, you always wanted to go live abroad. Why don't you go? And I said, great. And they said, how are you going to pay for it? And so that's when I went to Italy. I lived on a farm and, you know, cleaned the bedrooms of tourists at a bed and breakfast. And I learned how to cook and speak Italian and became fluent in Italian and connected with my family roots and cousins who lived over there. So a really great experience. I called my boyfriend and said, why don't you come too? And so he came for another year. That boyfriend's now my husband. So in total, I lived there almost 2 years. And
so
while
great.
It was the best. And while I was there, I applied to grad school and got in to Boston College.
What were you going to get a degree in?
Applied developmental psychology.
If you're wondering, as I did, what exactly does Biz mean by applied developmental psychology? These are people who study human growth and development over the lifespan, including physical, cognitive, social, intellectual, perceptual, personality, and emotional growth. Sounds pretty interesting to me.
Yesterday, when we were in your class, you referred to Erickson and you referred to Jesuits and you referred to philosophers. Is the point of your work to try to situate these kids into a set of academic traditions such that they are inserting themselves into like the grand conversation?
Absolutely. So the value of having a developmental theory to explain human mm-hmm. development shows you that, first of all, it's not all arbitrary. That yes, there are thousands of variables playing in to who we are, but to say there's a natural unfolding of the human being.
Across time, across culture, that we've been observing ourselves mature and not mature,
right?
Develop and be stunted for thousands of years, and that there is just this massive array of theories and points of view about how and when maturation happens.
Right, with variables as of race, class, gender, ethnicity, sexuality, faith, spirituality.
Economics.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And so all of those are playing into account. And it's not just how we feel about them. As I say to my students, we're becoming who we are because we respond to how people respond to us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I come out of the psychological literature, but our philosophers are saying much of the same thing. And so are the thinkers in all of the other disciplines. That's what liberal arts are. It's that convergence of meaning and purpose and understanding.
It has that like points back to a variety of disciplines.
Yes.
Well, presumably the point of forcing a core, forcing a curriculum, is that ideas in one discipline lead you to different ideas in another discipline. And that if you have this broad base to draw upon, you might find solutions that you wouldn't otherwise.
Absolutely. And so when I was a sophomore, I was taking an American history class on the 20s, the Roaring 20s, and the Depression that followed. And we were reading Ernest Hemingway. We were reading an English book in a history class, and it was relating to my economics class. I was also hearing similar things in my adult psych class.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all coming together.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember talking to my professor that evening after class. I was kind of walking out and I said, you know, it's pretty interesting because this relates a lot to what I've been learning in my adult psych class. And he said, Biz, that's the liberal arts.
Mm-hmm.
It was intended, but not intended.
Coming up next, Biz explains to me the importance of teaching her students how to think, not what to think. We'll be right back with Kelly Corrigan Wonders. This episode was funded by the great people at the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. You can learn more about this fantastic organization at avdf.org. The Arthur Vining Davis Foundations, investing in our common future. The 10% Happier podcast has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn. So why not master it? Hosted by Dan Harris, a journalist who had a panic attack on national television and then set out on a journey of transformation. He's now on a quest to help others also achieve peace and happiness. Every week, Dan talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity in wide-ranging conversations that explore topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. The interviews cover everyone from Brené Brown to Alexander Draymond to Sam Harris. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. Find 10% Happier wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome back to Kelly Corrigan Wonders. I'm Kelly Corrigan, and I'm on the campus of Boston College talking with Professor Dr. Biz Brocker. Back when I was in school, I loved walking campus. I left for class early so that I could make room for connections. And funnily enough, as Tammy and I were wandering around Boston College, we had an experience that is so typical of exactly what I remember best, making connections.
Is this Gasson Hall?
Yeah, this is Gasson.
Okay.
Do you
Great.
Love it? Do you think this campus is so beautiful?
It is beautiful. Yeah.
Do you feel it every day?
I feel it every day.
You do, or are you just
Almost
saying that?
Almost every day, yeah.
We're going to
yeah,
be
where are you guys
in
headed?
Biz
Brocker.
Biz
yes.
Brocker.
Oh my gosh, I had Biz Brocker last semester.
What's your name?
Claire Kerrigan.
Claire,
yeah.
Nice to meet you.
Kelly
nice
Corrigan,
you.
Claire Kerrigan. So are you a senior?
I'm a senior.
Yeah. How do you like it here?
It's awesome. I love it. I'm very far from home, but
where's home?
I'm from California. But
where?
It's like outside of San Francisco.
Where?
I'm from like the Atherton area.
Oh, I'm from
near
Piedmont.
Oh my gosh. Okay. I yeah. have very close family friends from Piedmont.
Who?
The Faust.
Oh my God!
Is that Margaret?
Margaret,
she's our intern.
No way, Margaret Faust. I love and miss you very much. No way, you
she's
guys.
Our intern.
What?
Do you have students or parents or other constituents who are coming to you and saying this is too expensive? We don't have time to give them the space. We need to have more of a career mindset, and rather than like this whole person stuff.
Well, certainly. the numbers will show you that. The cost of higher education is way, way outside of the realms of cost of living increases and such. Yeah, it's a luxury to be able to sit around for 4 years and imagine your life in the liberal arts, right? But I would argue that what we are in the business of doing at a liberal arts university is helping our students learn how to think, not what to think, but how to think, how to be curious, first of all, how to make connection. And that allows us to be flexible. And if there's anything our economic markets have taught us, is that we have to be flexible. So every year the USA's media comes out with, here are the jobs you should get if you want to be able to make money. You know, here are the highest paying jobs right out of college. And if you look at them, so many of them could eventually be automated. But what about how to think and how to be a human being and how to recognize that your education isn't just for you, but for the greater good of humanity?
Well, one of the things that you asked your students to read was involved a little bit of the history of higher education. And it talked about how initially it was for a very small set of people, white men, and it was really rooted in religions.
Right.
And then it became a secular thing. And then there was this moment where the idea of it as job training entered the conversation. And what you're saying through this conversation, but also the courses you teach, is it would be a mistake to let it become narrow, and that really the gift of it is the breadth.
Absolutely.
What are the names of the courses you teach?
I'm the director of the Cornerstone Seminar Program in the Morrissey College of Arts and Sciences at Boston College. The class I teach that comes under Cornerstone is The Courage to Know, which is a look at the way we internalize and understand ourselves and others through race, class, gender, ethnicity, sexuality, faith.
What kind of stuff do people read in your class and what kind of stuff do they talk about?
We start with a book by Celeste Ang called Everything I Never Told You. Mm-hmm. And we just finished that last week.
What was her big book that she wrote?
Little Fires Everywhere.
Right.
But I would argue this is a better book. A Lesson Before Dying by Ernest Gaines. So 1940s post-plantation era, a man who is not literate, a plantation field worker, and he is in the wrong place at the wrong time, found guilty by a jury of his peers, which it was not. And it was not hard to teach 10 years ago, but students couldn't relate to it the way that they can relate to it now with everything that's happened in our country around Black Lives Matter. And all of a sudden they say, wait a second, we're still dealing with this and it still happens.
Do you have a theory about why reading a book like that allows for certain insights and conversations that are not available if you were to talk just directly about today's news or George Floyd?
Because in those books, you can get into the heads of the character. And in the paper, you're getting a second, third, fourth hand evaluation through somebody else's lens. And most of the time we learn what we learn at our own dinner tables and in our own living rooms and family rooms. And it's hard when you are raised in particular belief sets to then take a look at that belief set and say, that doesn't make sense to me if you don't have real data. And being in the mind of someone who's sitting in a jail cell in 1940 and knowing that he's going to die and has been called a hog, and that it's that the death isn't even worth the electricity because he's just a hog. That's human dignity washed away by society.
And do you feel when you're teaching that book, for instance, that your kids are right there, that they can feel it and hear it and understand it?
I work really hard to get them to that point. And so I didn't do a lot of this, although I did a little bit of this in class. I read a lot of passages. I used to ask them to read a lot of passages and I would get very monotone, and they'd stumble over words and punctuation.
Plus your dad used to read to you, so you're living something out.
Yeah,
right?
That's a good point. I didn't think about that. I read it to them and I put intonation. I'm reading it to them so they're watching a play. They're watching the story. They're in the room. in the conversation.
Do you feel that there's like a little bit of acting and a little bit of stand-up and a little bit of lecturing and a little bit of parenting and coaching? Like when I was watching you yesterday, I thought, she must be so tired when this is over, because you know the whole success of the enterprise at some level is hanging on your ability to hold their attention and to like trigger their imagination.
Teaching is a performing art. And anybody who doesn't feel exhausted when they walk out, I think they're missing out on something. Mm-hmm. Believe me, not every day I can give as much as I did the last time, but I get in a zone and I don't even realize how tired I am. They give me energy. And quite honestly, I figure I have to be here. You have to be here. Let's have fun together. Like let's
put some heart in this thing.
Yeah.
You talked a lot about empathy yesterday and that there's a requirement for empathy in society. Say more about that.
Some people would argue there's a growing body of literature that without empathy, we will never have peace. We will never have a true understanding of our neighbors. Empathy is about understanding that we are all part of the human experience, and that just because I haven't lived your experience doesn't mean I don't understand the emotions and the pain or the joy that come with those experiences.
You also made a point of talking about solidarity and specifically that idea that I am neither better nor less than you. We are of equal importance. Is that your working definition of solidarity for the kids?
That's how it's been told to me and how I've come to understand it. It's more than I want you to succeed. It's I'm willing to give up my seat for you. Mm. I'm willing because I don't deserve it any more or less than you do. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's different from fighting as an ally for somebody.
Uh-huh. There's such incredible distinctions to be making at this time in American society, don't you think?
Yes, without a doubt, because it's playing out every minute of our lives, right?
Yeah.
And at Boston College, there's a lot of talk about solidarity because there's such a big commitment to social justice and putting yourself in communities where you feel way outside of your comfort zone, which has become a bit of a cliche these days, like get outside of your comfort zone. And I don't think students really know what that means.
Is every professor at BC Catholic?
No, I'm not Catholic.
Is every professor at BC Christian?
No, of course not. That's
because the Jesuit piece is a really big deal. It's really an underpinning. And when I was reading the materials to get ready for class yesterday,
yes,
which I
good for
done,
you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I was thinking about what is the impact of that environment? Because one of the pieces was saying that we put things like service to all on our materials and we carve them into sides of buildings. But the number one major in America is econ. And if you ask kids, why are you an econ major? They say, because I want to make money.
Right.
So that there's a huge disconnect between what's painted in the auditorium and what's like stitched into the heart of these kids.
Well, one thing that I find very endearing about this generation of students is that they feel a true responsibility for the amount of resources that have been allocated to their education.
That's cool.
It is cool because I don't think I spent a whole lot of time thinking about that. Now, granted, it wasn't quite the same percentage of my family's income. But at the same time, I do hear students saying all the time, for the amount of money that this college experience is costing me, I need to be doing the best I can. Mm-hmm. The problem lies in the fact that they think perfection is the best that they can do. And we talk a lot about chasing your tail because you cannot be perfect.
A big thing I think about with college, and especially with a class like yours, is that you really benefit from small group discussion. Mm-hmm. And that the reason that you're physically in the same room is to talk to each other, is to create those conversations that might yield some new way of thinking or doing that would be to the benefit of all.
And you go back to my developmental roots, it's about connection. Mm-hmm. And human beings were meant to connect. We have a word for those who can't connect to other human beings, and that's sociopath, right? But most of us are hardwired to connect and find ourselves in the other. That's what intimacy and love is being seen by another for who you really are and seeing others who they really are and helping them be their best self. And when I say best self, I mean their integrated self, their most authentic self.
Yeah, for sure. You said in your syllabus that you wanted everybody to bring an attitude of hospitality towards all ideas. And I thought that was such a great metaphor that you would, if it were straight hospitality, right, you would pull the chair out and you would create space for it. You would, you know, facilitate its sharing.
It means allowing someone to bring their whole self to the conversation, to the room. I've always felt that way about Boston College. It is an environment that allows me to bring my whole self. So you ask, are all the faculty Catholic or are they all Christian? No, and we're allowed to bring our whole selves to be able to say, this is valuable to me. I'm valuable to the conversation. And hospitality is at the root of all the major religions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
One thing I wanted to add is I think we want people to use their gifts. And I want my students who are inclined to go into the business world, I want them to go into the business world after a BC education, because we need good leaders in the business world. We need ethical practices. We need good managers who understand that their employees might be juggling hardships in their families when they go home and how to be able to handle that and deal with that. Or the bottom line is not the only thing.
Right.
And so my own husband, who went to BC with me, has an undergraduate degree from here. So he's a finance major, and he picked up a philosophy double major during his undergrad, then went on to Marquette for a master's of philosophy, and then came back to BC for a master's of science and finance. And now he works in the mutual fund industry and has worked in the hedge fund industry. And I've been told by his colleagues that he's a really great team member, that he can pivot easily, and that he's a really great boss.
Yeah.
And that's what we need in our business world.
Right. A couple other books that you have on your mm-hmm. syllabus are Tuesdays with Maury, which I was really surprised to see. Brian Stevenson's Just Mercy. How do the kids respond to those?
Well, Brian Stevenson came to BC on an electric night, brought to BC by the Lowell Humanities Series and the Pulse Program, which is our combination theology and philosophy core with 10 hours of service in the Boston community. And you know Brian, I've met Brian a few times, and he's just such a warm personality and is fighting the good fight.
I mean, 150 guys on death row have his cell phone number.
Unbelievable, right?
It's like you're the most important person in 150 people's lives.
Right, exactly. And he says something that's very Ignatian when he talks about being proximate. That is about putting yourself in someone else's shoes. That's about solidarity. That's about human dignity. And that's exactly what my quote on the board yesterday from Father Klovenbach was all about, is that we need to be in the spaces that make us uncomfortable because they're not ours, to make it personal so that it becomes important to us. Before I had met Brian and before I had read his stuff, and I've listened to every interview he's been on, and he's talked about being proximate many, many, many times, I used to say, make it personal. I would say, if you're wondering how you should treat another person, imagine them as your sister, as your mother, as your uncle, someone who matters to you. My grandfather, who was a very, very wise man, when someone was not being particularly nice about somebody, saying something not particularly nice, my grandfather would always say, she's somebody's sweetheart.
Mm-hmm. As if, somebody's baby, I always think.
As if to say, she matters to somebody else.
What's the final project in your class?
Why? Okay, so I have my first year students do an expanded version of Edward R. Murrow's This I Believe statement, the award-winning series. And I expanded a bit to say, what do you believe and how has it been influenced by your first year of college and by this class in particular? The readings, the film, the conversations. And so I tell my students, it could be a belief that they've always had and it was made stronger by this experience, or it may be something that they'd never thought of before. And now they've realized it's something important to them.
Are you floored by these papers?
I guess I'm not floored because I get to watch the progression of it happen. It's gradual. It's not overnight. There are occasions when there's a really quiet person in the class and then boom, drop the mic. Like I turn to my husband and I say, you've got to read this.
Yeah.
And when I'm grading, I'm grading on the couch or at the kitchen table, and I'll say to whoever's in the room, like, listen to this. What I do love is that when students turn this paper in, they often say to me, I didn't want to do anything else this week of exams. I just kept wanting to work this paper because I really liked it.
I bet their parents love it. I mean, I would love to know what my kids believe.
Well, and there's oftentimes I ask them to share it with their parents. And at the end, the first semester ends just about Christmas. And I say, what a great Christmas present to give to your parents. Or the second semester ends right around Mother's Day and Father's Day, which would be a great time. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes they need to wait a little bit because they've come to believe something that they were not taught.
Yes,
or
that
taught
might be
the contrary.
Startling or upsetting.
Right. And they definitely don't want to hurt their parents and their families. They want to be good stewards of their love. But that's a growing process, right?
Right. I mean, that's really a terrific use for college.
Yeah.
Is to separate from your parents, to be able to see their beliefs as something outside of you and decide which you want to internalize and which you want to reject and which you're still working on.
And why? And that's the most important question of it, is not just that you do want to do it, but what was the trajectory? What influenced you? And what isn't quite right still? Mm-hmm. And ultimately, I see my job as their Courage to Know teacher to help them hear their inner voice. I always say to my students, the people in your life that you love, who you go to for advice, they get one vote. You always get two.
That's
and
great.
So often they give the power to other people and they silence their own voice, or they think their voice doesn't matter. And I'm trying to help them find their gut and to listen to it.
Right. And have the courage to listen to it, the courage to know.
The courage to know, which is a mashup between Socrates, Know Thyself, and Parker Palmer, The Courage to Teach, which then we turned into The Courage to Know.
Courage. It can be scary to learn new ideas, to discover that you might be wrong or that your thinking is somehow biased. It won't be the last time this word comes up in the Live from College series.
Guess what? We require philosophy and theology. And did you think Courage to Know would talk this much about faith and faith formation? And I'm sure that you're talking about it perhaps in your English classes, or maybe it's coming up in psychology, or maybe in your early education classes. That's purposeful and meaningful to get you to imagine yourself in the readings. Who are you in that text? What do you think about it? What resonates?
There was a quote that I pulled from another one of the readings. In a world where the measure of things so often trumps the meaning of things, the practical, immediate uses of knowledge often overshadow the larger, more enduring purposes of education. If you had to say in closing, what are the larger, more enduring purposes of education? Can you give us two or three that you really hope every kid who crosses your path leaves campus with?
I hope that they understand that they need to have an opinion, that they do have an opinion on things, and their voice matters. As long as it's been explored and examined, that they're not irresponsible with an opinion, but that they've looked at all sides, that they've explored how their opinion is different from the other. I think the other piece that I am seeing more and more these days, especially in the midst or post-pandemic, how do I put this in words? This constant pursuit of perfection that breaks kids down in a generation. And I'm part of this generation, right? I have college kids as well. We parents and caregivers hold an awful lot of power, not just with our expectations, but our words and our facial expressions and our reactions that our kids take in.
I mean, they know everything.
Right.
I remember saying to Edward 1,000 times over the years when the kids were still under our roof, like, they know our opinion on everything.
Yeah.
We don't even need to verbalize it anymore. They've collected 1,000 clues over 10,000 days, and they know our opinion on absolutely everything.
Right. And they hold us to those too. They watch for missteps and inconsistencies and point them out, which frustrates us, right? Mm-hmm. And when that does happen, we can't be so proud that we don't listen to their voice.
Mm-hmm. So let's end on these three questions about how to think about yourself in the world. There are three questions that you mentioned yesterday in class that you want the kids to think about.
Yeah. So our esteemed colleague from the theology department and a dear friend, Father Michael Himes, he has presented this to students for over a decade now. And the three questions are, what brings you joy? What are you good at? And what does the world need you to do? And he brings those up in the midst of a conversation about vocational calling, because it's hard for these students to imagine what it means to be called to do something. They're waiting for the lightning bolt moment, or they're looking at one of the periodicals to tell them what's the best job to pursue to pay back their loans, right? But those bigger questions, your vocation answers all three of those and doesn't compromise on them. And it doesn't mean that you have to cure cancer. Does the world need you to do that? Of course it does. But it doesn't have to be the big things. It also needs you to be protective of the common good in whatever way that you need to do that.
I mean, the world needs ethical people. I mean, it just does. Right. Like, we have to keep tipping to the right side.
Right. And that's what education fundamentally was always meant to do.
Was to create ethical people.
Right.
Yeah. Biz, how'd you feel about your first pod?
This was great. I could talk to you all day. I mean, there's a lot to talk about. And as a parent, I'm grateful for this series because I think so many parents don't know how to wrestle this stage of their parenting life.
Yeah.
Because it was so different for us.
For sure. I talked to my mom like once a month.
And, you know, many of our friends got on a train and the family left you at the train station.
Yes, for sure.
And, you know, nowadays parents are asking at orientation, who's going to wake up my son for class? And is anybody going to show them how to get to the airport? And I'm not on the, I don't know if you're on any of the Facebook groups for your kids' schools.
No way.
I am not on the Boston College one because it's just too close to home. But for my middle son, who's a freshman, I wanted to be sure I was engaged in his community. And I'll tell you, I just can't even believe the questions that parents are asking from across the globe on behalf of their students who are right there on the ground.
I know. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for what you do.
Yeah, thank you for what you do. You're sending some nice kids out into the world.
Thanks.
Here are my takeaways from my conversation with Dr. Biz Brocker. Number one, the liberal arts are a convergence of meaning and purpose and understanding. Number two, the hope and the point of forcing a core curriculum on students is the idea that one discipline leads you to different ideas in a different discipline, which may lead you to new solutions. Number three, the business of a liberal arts university is helping students learn not what to think, but how to think, how to be curious, how to make connections, and how to recognize that your education isn't just for you, but for the greater good of humanity. Number four, teaching is performing, and anyone who doesn't walk out exhausted might be missing the mark. Number five, there's a growing body of literature that tells us without empathy, we cannot have peace. Number six, when we say your best self, what we mean is your most authentic, integrated self. Number seven, Teaching ethics to future business leaders is well worth every penny we spend on tuition. Number 8, we might all benefit from asking ourselves the 3 questions that every Boston College student is posed. What brings you joy? What are you good at? And what does the world need you to do? Of course, I want to thank Professor Biz Brocker and her TA, Lily Kennedy, as well as everyone at Boston College for having us on campus. We had a total blast. I'd also like to thank the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations, investing in our common future. I want to thank everyone at Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That's technical producer Dean Kateri, executive producer Tammy Stedman, the guy sitting next to me right now as I record this, Luke Sheeler, who is our recording engineer, our charming and capable assistant, Paige Rayburn, our very clever graphic designer, Goggy, and a special shout-out to our former intern, Margaret Faust. We'll be back on Friday with another For the Good of the Order, and on Sunday for another Thanks for Being Here. Until then, I'll see you on Instagram, @KellyCorrigan.